Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and you may be hearing the pitter-patter of rain in the back of this introduction because it is coming down out there. Torrential. For the last few days, it's rained nonstop, and I, for one, love it. I hope that you all are loving it, too. I hope that you're staying dry, staying warm, staying off the road. It's just driving needlessly when it's raining out is such a gamble that's unnecessary. Even if you're driving fine, even if you're like, I know how to drive in the rain, a lot of people behind you don't. So if you don't need to get out there right now, stay at home and curl up next to the fire with your kitty cat and a warm cup of Earl Grey tea. Big thank you to Will Tote. Big thank you to Walshy. And big thank you to Jim Fadiman for being paid supporters of this podcast. This podcast is hosted on Substack. It's where I give you my newsletters. It's where you can comment on these podcasts. It's all over there at Substack. And the people like you who are supporting this show with just $6 a month, or you can be a baller and go $50 a year, I just really appreciate all of you. Makes a huge difference. This podcast has always been a passion project for me, and it's been just amazing to watch it grow, evolve, and continue to reshape over the years. And it's also something that does require a lot of time, a lot of work, tracking these guests down, getting the questions prepared, uploading the podcast. I do it all myself. So for those of you who enjoy listening frequently, for those of you who feel like, you know what, I get $6 a month worth value out of this, please consider becoming a paid subscriber. You can just click the link below this podcast, sign up for the newsletter, and become a paid subscriber. So thank you to those three who are supporting it. And you guys may recognize the voice or the name Jim Fadiman, because he has been a past guest on this show. He's also the father of the microdosing movement and author of the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. So you'll be in good company supporting Mr. Jim Fadiman, supporting this podcast along with Mr. Jim Fadiman, rather. That's all I'll say for now. Click the link below. And also, if you like this podcast, give it a rating on iTunes. You can just click the link below the show. It helps me get more guests, helps legitimize the podcast. And thank you so much. That's all the asks for today. That's all the housekeeping. Now we can get on to the great show. And this was a great show. I learned a hell of a lot about fishing methods, about farm fishing practices. The guest today is someone who I have known for quite some time. I've wanted to get him on the show for quite some time, and we finally made it happen. James Arthur began the journey into regenerative aquaculture as a teenager volunteering at the Nature Interpretive Center in Southern California, where he got firsthand experience with a steelhead trout breeding and hatchery program. For 10 years, he lived abroad and sailed around the Pacific from San Francisco to Ecuador and the Galapagos Islands. Throughout that time, he's been on a mission to visit open ocean aquaculture farms, vetting claims, lab testing seafood, and connecting the best-in-class aquaculture projects to farm-to-table restaurants in California. In 2020, he founded Seatopia, or a gourmet seafood subscription box, now delivering certified mercury-safe seafood, carbon-neutral, direct to homes nationwide. Through Seatopia, he is working to scale a truly regenerative seafood supply chain and empower health-conscious consumers to directly support innovative aquaculture projects, producing some of the healthiest protein on the planet. This was a wide-ranging conversation. We talked about childhood. We talked about living on the North Shore. We talked about sailing around the world. We talked about John Steinbeck, and we talked a hell of a lot about the future of fish. Please give it up for James Arthur. Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. James in the house. The water spout. So good to see you, man.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks for coming over. I met you years ago through our mutual friend Kaj. One of the first times I met you, you made the trek from Los Angeles up to Santa Cruz for my curated feast.
Yes.
Which went off without a hitch. For people who don't know, this was like maybe year two of the podcast. I had this idea to do a multi-course meal made from only ingredients in the Santa Cruz area. My buddy Ty, childhood friend, was a chef, and he's like, he was starting his own business at the time. And he's like, I want to practice doing these big feasts for like 20 people. And we also had at the time a friend who was a food historian.
That was beautiful.
Right? So this woman, Liz, between every single course that would come out, she would tell the historical context of the food as the plates were being served. And it was just one of the most erudite dinners I've ever had. I think we had Jim Fadiman from the Psychedelic Explorer's
right
Guide.
Jim Fadiman, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
So interesting and fun.
We had Fadiman. We had Kyle Kingsbury, this UFC fighter from Austin, Texas, podcaster who came out. We had my friend Ben. Do you know Ben? He was a Nat Geo photographer.
Yeah. So how Ben do you? Well. I knew Ben, I think, prior to that.
You did? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That dude's awesome. Yeah. So it was just another example of all the great things that can come from podcasting. Wallace J. Nichols.
Wallace J. Nichols.
Did you know Jay at all before
Not
that?
Not before, no.
Okay.
No.
I feel like you and Jay would kind of love each other.
I did really enjoy spending time with him. I loved his book. His book was like just poetry.
Yeah. For people who don't know, Wallace J. Nichols, he wrote Blue Mind, and he also, it's basically a book about what happens to your mind on water, on the ocean. And he lives up in Davenport, I believe, and will always, whenever you see him, he'll pass out little blue marbles. Did he give you a blue marble?
He did. Yeah, we got blue marbles that day. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a fun...
I had already read his book, so I was really stoked to meet him that day. And yeah, just nerd out on... Yeah, what a great collection of people. Thank you.
And you brought a kompachi.
I brought a bunch of kompachi, yeah.
So what is a kompachi for people who don't know?
Seriola revoliana is a type of yellowtail. Off the coast of California, we have Seriola lalandi and then Seriola revoliana. Oftentimes a little further south, is a type of yellowtail in the Jack family that has kind of become a shining star of aquaculture. It was featured in Four Fish, Greenberg's book.
Alan Greenberg?
I believe so.
Something like that. I've seen that TED Talk.
Yeah. Yeah, he has a great book. He has a couple of really good books. It's been featured in Forbes magazine. Basically, it's an example of a species that has a metabolism that works well for aquaculture. So, and on top of that, also is delicious, has a high fat content, is familiar to chefs, familiar in sushi bars as kompachi, sashimi, kompachi collars. So hamachi, super popular in sushi bars. Kompachi is a relative of that.
A sister of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I remember you brought, I think it was just a whole fish. Right? Was it a whole kombucha?
I think I brought a handful of whole kombuchas, and we broke them down fresh right there and made sashimi and paired them with some local oysters and some local, I think, foraged seaweeds. Yeah.
Okay. So you were you doing Seatopia back then?
No. At the time, I was working with this kombucha farm in La Paz, and we were raising these fish that are native to the area, literally collecting native species about a dozen at a time, put them in these land-based pools, tweaking the lighting in the room to trick them into spawning, collecting the fermented offspring, raising those to a size that was large enough to put into offshore pens, feeding them an organic diet with algaes, and raising them to maturity. And then these beautiful, you know, antibiotic-free, hormone-free, just examples of the best sushi-grade, beautifully raised fish in the world were being sold at the time through import-export sales channels. So okay. That's what I was doing back then.
Okay, so we're going to get to this, and then we're going to get into what it eventually became, which is Seatopia.
Yeah.
But I want to dig in a little bit more to your past and how all of this came to fruition from the beginning. So where did you grow up?
Mostly between San Diego, Chula Vista, and then I moved to the North Shore Oahu when I was a teenager. So grew up surfing Imperial Beach and sometimes skipping first period and going and surfing the spot called Baja Malibu on the other side of the border. That's how close we were.
You could still
get back by second period.
Oh yeah.
And
go get some, get all your tetanus shots out of the way before going surfing right around those areas.
It has progressively gotten dirtier. Yeah. BMs, as we used to call it, or also as some people refer to bowel movements as appropriate name.
That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah. But great place to learn how to paddle against offshore wind and get barreled.
Sure. So you grew up as South San Diego kid, grew up surfing. What was your social life? How would you describe your childhood?
Not super social, to be honest. I grew up, when I was really young, my dad was a lifeguard. He worked, in La Jolla, and when he was, you know, watching us, he would just take us to the beach. So I was in the water a lot. I don't know, a few years younger than the kids that were doing junior lifeguards, and I was running the junior lifeguard program with them, or not running it, but, you know, doing the program with them. But when they split, my mom and dad split, I still, I was living mostly with my mom and my older sister. But we weren't super social in I think we're just not allowed to socialize out of the circle of our sort of like church group friends. It was pretty controlling and weird, and kind of, without getting too far into the details, just kind of forced me to be like, this is not the home I want to live in. And I actually moved out when I was 16 and ended up on the North Shore of Oahu.
Wow. And had you been to the North Shore before then?
I'd never been on an airplane.
Holy shit. Yeah. Full on Rick Kane style, man. You're going for it.
I hadn't even seen that movie North Shore when I moved to the North Shore. I didn't know much about it. I just knew I had to get out, and I knew one person who lived there. And it was a very lonely, but good experience.
Right. It's kind of the beginning of the hero's journey in some ways, right? You have your comfortable, or you have what's familiar, and then right around that time you need to take that plunge into the unknown, wherever it may be. And for often, you know, as a teenager, it is your first big trip.
Yeah, I remember crying on really? That airplane. Yeah, I was like I'm never gonna see my family again, even though it wasn't like I'm still not that close to them, but, you know, I was such a little kid. When I look at 16-year-old today, I'm like, that's a child. And,
yeah.
And it's wild to think that I was
on a plane
figuring
alone.
It out.
Wow. Yeah. What did your parents think of you going on this trip? Because you were essentially going to live there, right? You said, I'm moving to the North Shore.
Yeah. I haven't been in touch with my father very much since I was an adolescent, but at the time I left, my mom gave me a note and signed it. It was like, basically like, he has our blessing type of thing.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was weird.
All right. So did you bring the note with you?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why, but yeah, that's all I had. I wasn't like formally emancipated or anything like that. It just was like, I'm out.
Wow. Okay. So you flying to the North Shore, or you flying Honolulu?
Yeah.
Did you get a cab? You said, take me to the North Shore.
No, my friend, who also grew up in Chula Vista, was living out there. He had moved out there like a year before me. By the time I got there, he had a girlfriend. He was actually living in Haleiwa, but he had just moved out of this room that he had been subletting at Cammie's, from Ken Bradshaw. And so I got nice. This room,
yep.
And I ended up living with Ken Bradshaw right there, sunset at Cammie's.
Wow. So you're surfing Rocky Lefts. You're Goofy Foot, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you're surfing Rocky Lefts. You're surfing Cammie's.
Yeah.
Bigger days, getting yourself out to sunset.
Yeah. Trying. And Ken was really cool, 'cause he has a similar story. He also was a teenage runaway, made his way from Texas to California and then California to Hawaii. And so he kind of like saw something in me and was very kind and
sure,
sort of fatherly.
And Ken Bradshaw is a legend in Hawaii, North Shore. Ken Bradshaw, Laird Hamilton, very much were innovators of tow-in surfing in what, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And yeah, just very absolute legend in yeah. that area. So a very lucky person to meet on your first foray to the North Shore, because it is, I think the North Shore is, it's many things to many people, but it's this place where you can very quickly be let into the group or excluded for life from the group, depending on those first few moves that you make.
Yeah.
And it can feel like a very intimidating and very scary place yeah. if you don't play your cards right.
Absolutely.
So did you feel like you understood that ethic growing, like going over there? How did you feel like you navigated the culture of the North Shore coming from San Diego?
It was really humbling. There was, fortunately, I was young enough to not be looked at as sort of like an adult coming into the community. I was more looked at like another kid. And so some of the other families were very extending their ohana.
Sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was like an orphan, you
yeah,
know, brought
sure.
into their family, right? And it was really beautiful. But in the hierarchy of kids my age, I wasn't really, there wasn't a lot of openings. There was a lot of, it was a different era. It was a lot, there was a lot of competition amongst males for waves and girls, of which it seemed like there was never enough.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you then, what were you doing for work over there?
My first job, I got a job in Mililani, which is like the middle of the island, at the YMCA. I would take a bus from Ken's house all the way to Mililani, which is like a 2-hour bus ride or something crazy. And I would teach swimming. I had already had like a first aid swimming instructor's Red Cross thing. And I was working at the Mililani teaching swimming to these little kids, which was a really beautiful and grounding experience for me, because I had these kids and their families looking at me and calling me uncle, because it's such a transformative experience for a toddler or a very young child to learn how to swim. And especially in Hawaii, it's such a cultural important phase of these families. And so I was facilitating that for these families, and it helped me feel a little bit more accepted in
sure.
those early days.
And also feel like you could see yourself as having a skill that you could teach to others. You know, like if you're over there just thinking of yourself as this orphan who knows nothing, doesn't have a community, like I could see it being a very unmooring experience from an identity standpoint. But to have an experience where you're actually teaching a skill that you know to others, to younger kids, I could see that being really helpful. One of my favorite stories that I have probably told too many times on this podcast is in the 1960s when Ken Kesey's electric acid Kool-Aid tests and came into the Haight-Ashbury, and there were more hippies taking LSD than any other era in any history before. There were a lot of people having panic attacks and ending up in the emergency room. And there was a doctor who went on to become very well-known named... Ooh, I'm going to think of it in just a second. But he... I can't think of it. But basically, he figured out this psychological trick to get people to stop panicking, which was he would go into the room and say, I know you're having a hard time, but there's someone just on the other side that's actually having a way worse time than you right now. So I really need you to hold it together. Wow. And in a moment, they'd be like, okay, I can get into this helper role now.
Yes.
And I think that it's a real interesting psychological trick that can get people to get their shit together really quickly when they feel like there's someone else who needs
to be of service.
Help more than them. Yeah.
Yes. To be of service.
And it's a very quick way out of depression and your own neuroses, right? Yeah. Just gets yourself out of your own way. Did you, before Hawaii, you obviously learned swimming. Was this from Junior Guards?
From Junior Guards. And then there was another really influential person in my community who invited me to learn how to sail. So this guy named Dick Mason, who was the professor at Southwestern Junior College, and he ran their aquatics program. And he had written all the grants and everything to start a whole sailing program. And on the Silver Strand, which is the spit of land that connects Coronado Island to Imperial Beach.
Right.
He had started this aquatics program where we had kayaks and Hobie cats and these little monohulls and canoes. And he was teaching kids in the community how to sail and kayak and canoe and all these things. And I was invited by him because he was a friend and kind of saw that I needed sort of a father figure. And I had learned to sail and then started working there. And I learned how to sail and got my whatever I needed. I think he kind of pushed me in that direction.
You already had sailing skills.
Yeah, even though I was pretty young, I was already sort of like pushed in another sense of like not being in like a healthy home. I was sort of pushed out and I was doing things that were surprisingly productive. I mean, obviously I was also doing unproductive things that kids do. I had also started volunteering at an aquarium that was also there on the South Bay, the Chula Vista Nature Interpretive Center. That was a really like amazing experience.
Super cool. So what were you doing at that aquarium?
Cleaning,
describe it for people.
Cleaning fish poop, feeding jellyfish, raising the little sea monkeys, the Artemia and rotifers that a lot of the filter feeders would eat, and feeding the we had bat rays and stingrays, and a really, really cool place.
Seems like you've been able to get yourself into these interesting situations pretty easily. Would you reach out directly and say, hey, I want to work here? How would you actually approach getting some of these jobs, whether it be the aquarium or teaching swimming at Mililani? Like, did you have any kind of approach that got people to say yes to you?
I've done my fair share of knocking on doors and showing up and volunteering and being willing to do things. Yeah. I think that was kind of part of my personality and just getting things done and maybe kind of like I'll figure this out kind of attitude. Nobody was going to do it for me.
People saw that in you.
Maybe, yeah.
Super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Dick Mason, I think, really more than anything, he wanted to help me. He was just like such a nice, like sort of angel in my trajectory early on. And John, I forget his last name, the aquarium lead, he had been in an accident, so he was paraplegic, and he really needed a lot of volunteers and helpers and assistants to do to maintain doing the job that he did.
He's like, sweet, free labor. Let's.
Oh yeah, he had a whole program of of interns and whatnot, and I just fit right into that. And he was an awesome human, and he actually got me started on aquaculture because he had this steelhead trout rehabilitation pilot project, or he was showing how in these estuaries, the steelhead trout used to go back up into these rivers and out back down in the oceans. And he had, you know, painted a picture for me of how we could raise enough of these steelhead to, in theory, put them back into the ocean, back into the estuaries, and you could raise enough to feed population and mitigate pressure on the oceans.
So he's imbuing this ethic into you early on.
Yeah, that was inception.
It's amazing how malleable you are at that age and how you don't think that you are. Think that no one can influence you. Like, I don't think that you at 14 are thinking, this is an influence. I'm being influenced by this person.
No, you think I am me. I am independent.
No one can tell me what to do. Meanwhile, you are just this little ball of Play-Doh. And depending on who comes into your sphere around that time, it has such an outsized benefit on your trajectory or outsized impact on your trajectory. I almost think of it like the first few years of investing in a Roth IRA or something, right? Like if you can compound that interest early on in life, it has these outsized impacts.
Absolutely.
Rather than, you know, later in life, I think you can still make changes, but that really is when you're setting up not only your habits and interests, but also your ethics. For better or worse, for sure.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately since I recently became a father, and then I've been having some correspondence with my father and reflecting on the early influence that he had. You know, it's like I'm 43 something years old and I haven't seen my father in person since I was, you know, single digits, but I'm seeing so many similarities in my path that I didn't realize were related to that early influence, right? It's so much, well, DNA one, but also just like the experiences that he imbued in those very early days, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that the fact that it's that you haven't seen him since single digits and you're still seeing influence.
Insanely, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, he lived in Costa Rica. He was a lifeguard. He lived in El Segundo, was a lifeguard here. And then I ended up like traveling, like we sailed to Costa Rica and we were looking at living there. Like, I've been living in LA. It kind of seems like kind of not that coincidental, but I didn't know some of these things until recently, and to realize that like we're on these similar parallel tracks, despite thinking that I am me as an independent human, you know, it's like when we, I don't know, it reiterates that idea that we aren't necessarily as unique as we thought we were. And so much of it is just,
no human is an island, man. Do you ever see that movie with Aaron Ralston, 127 hours, I think that's what it's called, about the dude who has to chop his arm off under the rock.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? Yes. Whole point of that movie is that no man is an island, right? And it's such a beautiful way to tell that story. Like, this dude's got his girlfriend who he doesn't really care about. He kind of just wants people to leave him alone. He thinks he can go out and do all this shit alone, doesn't need any help. And then he gets his arm caught under this boulder and goes through these hallucinatory revelations, you know, for these days that he thinks he's going to die, and then ultimately cuts his arm off. But I mean, there's this scene in the movie where he cuts his arm off, tourniquets it, he's running to try and get help, and he sees in the distance there's just this family, and they're walking away from him, and he goes, "Help! I need help! I need help!" And she's like, oh, it's fucking powerful, dude. Oh, we're a communal species, dude. We need other people.
Yes. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And we also need to be alone. We need that journey.
Yeah.
I guess it is that hero's journey. Yeah. We need to go off into the woods. We need to go out into nature and appreciate having a home and a nest and partners.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the community. Like the path of the middles, right? It's constantly finding where our edges are on either side of it and finding what is best for each of us, right? There really are some people that love working out in the middle of nowhere all summer long and, you know, being on fire watch in the middle of some national forest and not talking to anyone for months and months. Not me, but I do see that we are all we're all configured differently. So when it comes to you and your dad, so are you guys emailing now that you're getting more of these pieces of your story and kind of learning about it? How is that correspondence happening?
Yeah, it's just been emails. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would you say it's done for you? I mean, it feels like kind of a big, like, we can talk about it as much or as little as you want, but I feel like that's just like a really interesting window into your life and your story in like a very deep way. Like, how are you, are you asking questions in the emails and like learning more about his story? How are you, how are you investigating this?
Yeah, I've, you know, since becoming a father, I have realized how precious every couple minutes is, right? Like to have an hour to just, you know, go surfing is super precious these days. So I haven't, put a lot of time into, investigating this other than saying, what do I need to know about my history, my DNA, my ancestry, and you? Like, I've been just asking a lot of questions about him and then, maintaining, you know, that sort of, taking the opportunity while I can to learn as much about the history and seeing and how that reflects on where I'm going, you know?
I don't know if I've told you this, but I'm writing a book about interviewing your parents.
Really?
And how to do it and why everyone should do it.
So
that's
to read this
that's
book.
The reason why I'm
because I don't have
a
guidebook. It's and it's,
yeah. And it's profound. It can be, you can fill in these missing plot points to your story by playing interviewer and asking your parents these questions that pretty commonly result in these holy shit moments for yourself. And I think that it is a real, it's a very simple and actionable thing you can do to get to know yourself better and understand more about who your parent is. And I think that it can also feel really good for the parent to just be asked some of these questions.
I think so.
Right? Because often they're not going to just tell you unless you ask.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's also this other side of it where I don't want to be overly influenced by the stories because it like so much of history is stories, right? Like in perspectives and how much of it is, I mean, there's a reason why I haven't maintained a relationship with him that is, you know, we don't need to get too into that, but essentially, you know, there's only, we are affected by the people that we surround ourselves with. And I don't want to have too much of that influence and I don't want to be too affected by those stories, if that makes sense.
No, totally. Yeah. I think that for most people, there are parts of our parents that we want to emulate and parts that we want nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And I think that we, just as our parents influence us, we're also influenced by peers, we're influenced by mentors, we're influenced by experiences, and we're influenced by our genes. Like it is this confluence of influences. And the more the reason I think that it serves us to ask these questions and get to know our parents' story more is that we get to then make decisions on how much we want to be influenced by that.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that it's a little bit like when you're 14 and you don't think you're being influenced, you're more easily influenced, you know, or like it's, you know, someone who's illiterate in marketing ads work better on people who don't understand marketing, right? Sure. So I think that that's a smart way to go about it. You know? And
then again, some marketing is so good, it just works.
Yeah, you know it's working on you, and yeah, you know it's working and you're still into it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're on the North Shore. Were you you had this experience with aquaculture. Were you a fisherman yourself?
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to do quite a bit of fishing when I was growing up, going out in like the local day boats. When I went to the North Shore, I brought one surfboard and one spear gun, and I would spearfish to have protein to eat, you know, like if it wasn't for spearfishing, I was eating peanut butter and
peanut butter and
top
spam.
Ramen, yeah. And that was it. So, yeah, I definitely grew up fishing and saw and deeply appreciated my relationship with the ocean. And I think that was also influenced by my father. He brought me to the Sea of Cortez when I was really little, and he was, you know, diving for scallops and bringing them up and cutting them up, and we would use that as bait, and we would create little bait balls and just be pulling up fish. And yeah, we spent a lot of time in the ocean, and that was very formative.
Mm. So you said that the trip to the North Shore was your first time on a flight, but you would drive down to the Sea of Cortez.
Yeah, drove all the way to Cabo from.
Wow, yeah. That's super cool.
Yeah.
Okay, and how do you dive for scallops? I've never done that before.
They're just clinging on rocks or in between the crevices of rocks, and well, it depends on the species. Some of them are you know, in the sand bottoms or whatnot. Yeah, there's a bunch of different species of scallops and the way in which they're either in a hold fast or just out filtering. In this case, you would go down with some sort of bar and just pry them off the rocks.
Okay. Is the Sea of Cortez where Steinbeck's The Pearl is based?
Steinbeck did a lot in the Sea of Cortez.
He did a lot,
yeah.
Right?
The log from the Sea of Cortez, which was a really beautiful adventure journal/scientific observation, fun one to read. And The Pearl takes place in La Paz.
Right.
And there used to be really productive pearl farming on Isla Espiritu Santo in the Sea of Cortez.
Okay, that's so fun.
Yeah, in La Paz.
Years ago on this podcast, I had this guy on who makes these really high quality, almost art piece surfboards out of Santa Cruz. And he found the original boat from the heart of the Sea of Cortez. That had been, I forget the exact story, but he had been using pieces of the wood from one of the rooms in the boat in his surfboards.
Wow.
And people were just going apeshit over like Steinbeck fans who want a surfboard on their wall that has a piece of the boat. But had never read the book at the time. This was before I was a big Steinbeck fan. And he gave me a little piece of wood from the boat after the podcast.
Rad.
I was like, oh, that's cool, but I'd never read the book. I wasn't that into it. But my housemate, this girl, Taylor, who just loved Steinbeck, she was at UCSE in their abalone research program, actually. She was researching the pinto abalone. I gave it to her, and she flipped the fuck out. Dude, it was like the best present she had ever had. And since then, I still have not read The Heart of the Sea of Cortez.
The log
of the Sea of Cortez.
Yeah.
But I have read The Pearl, which is a great book.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love that one.
Yeah. Yeah, the pearls from that region were, like, ending up in, like, the crown of the, you know, Spanish nobles. It was pretty wild. The quality of the pearls in that region in that time were world renowned.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But that book was really cool, and I tried to kind of recreate that a little bit when during COVID my wife and I sailed from Los Angeles down to and into the Sea of Cortez and spent like two years cruising from here all the way to Costa Rica.
Good way to spend COVID.
But that time in the Sea of Cortez was probably the the highlight. Just what a wonderful, magical place.
Was this before you had a kid?
Yes.
Okay, final hurrah. Yes. Did you plan the trip before COVID?
I started planning that trip when I was a little kid. my mom actually, at one point, provided me with a bunch of the stuff that she'd been storing. And there was like these like drawings that I had from like third grade. And I had all these drawings of sailboats. And it had been early in my psyche that one day I was going to sail and I was going to sail around the world. And so this was like a vision for me for a long time. So my wife and I lived on our on a sailboat for almost 10 years. And during COVID, we finally had the time and space to go somewhere farther. And so, yeah, we took off.
Were you living on your sailboat in Marina Del Rey?
Yep. We were living in Marina Del Rey.
I think I met you maybe for the first time
in
Marina Del Rey years ago. And I took a little tour on your sailboat. And I wanted to say we just took stand-up paddleboards around Marina Del Rey. This is before I moved to Los Angeles.
I remember that. I think it was even like a full moon psilocybin paddleboarding.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Yeah. How dare you talk about drugs on this podcast? How dare you? So tell me more about that trip. And what you were hoping to hit on that trip. So it was just you and your wife?
And a dog.
Cool.
We had a elderly dog at the time. She was, I think, 17 or something like that. A little poodle. Just me and my wife. So we had the boat that you visited was a smaller boat that we lived on at first. And then we saved up and we got a bigger boat. A 46-foot Cal 1976, Cal 246, which is a boat that was kind of like a dream boat for me. Just really cool design that sails really well and also has great living accommodations and beautiful big windows, lots of light that comes in there. We really started out just like we're going to go to Ensenada to haul out the boat and, you know, do the bottom paint and start just like really the foundational work. And then COVID accelerated and we're like, there's no reason to go back to LA and we should just, you know, go further south. And we didn't necessarily, we weren't fully equipped at the time. There was still a lot of things we didn't have. Like we didn't have a, we didn't have a dinghy at that time. We didn't have a life raft. We didn't have an EPIRB. We didn't have like any of the things that you really need for proper offshore sailing. But it was kind of like, if we don't go now, we're not going to go ever.
Sure.
We're probably just going to get back into the rat race.
Yeah. Necessity is the mother of invention.
And next thing you know, like on a March winter windswell, we're like headed south and just riding these like 20 to 30 knot winds down the coast of Baja and made it down to Cabo. And that was
so
a
fun, hectic,
amazing adventure that would have been much better with a couple bros instead of just me and my wife and an elderly dog. But we pulled it off. We did have one other girl on the boat. We had a friend come with, but two girls that don't sail and a dog and myself and way more wind than we needed. But we made it we had a few different stops along the way. We kind of just like wherever there was a safe anchorage where we could rest and then kept going. But the goal was to get up into the Sierra Cortez and spend as much time in those sort of MPAs, those marine protected areas. La Paz has some really great ones around Isla Espiritu Santo. On the Pacific side, we really wanted to visit the sites where the whales, the gray whales come and birth and breed, which is an incredible experience to see.
Where is this?
There's three bays on the Pacific side of Baja that the entire population of Eastern Pacific, which is most of the gray whales, they all congregate here. So this is Bahia San Ignacio, Bahia Magdalena, and Guerrero Negro. And these three bays from January to March are, there's literally thousands and thousands of gray whales in these tiny protected lagoons. And you go out in a panga and they will literally, not all of them, but some of them will literally come up to the boat and allow you to interact with them, touch them. They'll bring their newborn babies to present them to you. And the energy is like they're showing you, and they're proud and they're excited to share with you what they're doing. And it feels like it's like some sort of transcendent experience. They're like, I want you to connect with us because you haven't been connected with us. And when you're not connected with us, bad things happen. There's some powerful, powerful magic that's happening in those bays. So we went there and we went to up into Bahia Los Angeles, which is another really amazing place. So I think you were telling me that you'd swam with whale sharks in La Paz.
Yeah.
So they're in La Paz in the winter, and then in the summer they go up to, or they go up to Bahia Los Angeles. And then some of them, when they're mating, we believe that, or when they're ready to spawn, they go out all the way to the Galapagos. But anyways, which is another place I've sailed to, but I was on a different trip. Anyways, we went all the way up into the Sea of Cortez and spent as much time as we could visiting marine protected areas, ocean parks, and various aquaculture sites all around there, like visiting some of the small sort of pilot projects. There's some guys working on scallops, and there's some people doing yellowtail and different types of oysters. There's this oyster cooperative up near San Felipe that it's like this all-woman cooperative trying to... So San Felipe used to be a big... Still is, sort of. It's a community that used to be highly dependent on fishing shrimp and totoaba. And the totoaba is now illegal to be caught because they were catching all the vaquita. And so now you have this entire community that was dependent on fishing, and they're trying to develop other types of fishing. So the oyster farming is now becoming like a new thing that they're trying to commercialize.
So sure.
The whole goal is to visit as many aquaculture sites and as many marine protected areas and just document it and spend time and swim with as many awesome creatures as we can while they're still there.
Mm.
That was really the driver. It was like, I want to see as much biodiversity in the ocean as I can, because I know that every single day we're losing those species. So
right.
That was like really the driver. It was like, see as much as we can while we can.
So, you are a man of many talents, but one you haven't talked about is photography. So did you bring your camera on the trip?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's it like? We have a photo of a whale on our wall here, and you're like, it's really difficult to photograph whales because they are whiter than you would think.
Some of them, yeah.
Some of them.
So crazy contrast. Yeah. Mm. Like the humpback whale is like white underneath and then like this dark gray on top. So depending on what side they're showing you, you have very different light balance and reflection. And so like when I was in the Galapagos, sailed out there with some friends, and our whole goal was to be doing some underwater photography of various species of sharks and whatnot. But we also were chasing humpbacks and following these sort of, these humpbacks that were in these breeding parades. And, when you're underwater and we'd get dropped off, for example, ahead of a bull or a female that was leading a bunch of bulls across, you know, just the open ocean, right? And they're just hauling ass. So you get dropped off ahead of where you think they're going to come, and you're pointing your camera into the darkness, trying to adjust aperture, shutter speed, everything, light to properly expose this creature that all of a sudden is either gray or bright white, depending if they're showing you underneath and whatnot. So it's really interesting to try to properly light
expose those animals.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. In fact, one time we were sailing, my wife and I actually sailing across the bay outside of Puerto Vallarta. Forget the name of that bay. But we were sailing along, and all of a sudden there was this bright white light that like was coming towards our boat. And at the time the only thing I could think of was there's an alien, like that's a UFO, because it was so big and it was so bright. But then as it passed, I was like, that was a whale. Just, it was showing us, it was like, it was upside down, just like, you know, showing us its belly, just cruising underneath the water. But it was like, imagine, you know, the blue ocean all of a sudden is reflecting light from this huge.
Wow. Yeah. That's so cool. Trippy. How'd you get into photography, underwater photography specifically?
My mom handed me a Canon AE-1 when I was really young, and was like, we're going to today shoot photos of textures, and tomorrow we're going to shoot photos of trees. And like, she was a real photographer back
then. She was.
When we used film and cameras.
Is that what she did for a living?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, she actually worked at SeaWorld doing like marketing photography for them. And that was another sort of influence for me and going down the path of aquaculture. That was actually how I started volunteering at the aquarium, was I was first enamored with what they were doing at SeaWorld. You know, as a little kid, getting sort of backstage access to meet some of these marine mammals and whatnot. I was like, wow, I want this job. I want to be a Shamu trainer. That was like my first job.
Okay. You had no choice. You were getting it from both ends. You were going to be in the ocean no matter what.
Yeah. But I got an underwater camera much later, and that was just because I wanted to do surf photography. And then surf photography transitioned eventually into shooting fish. And it was kind of an evolution from spearfishing to actually just wanted to get closer to them. As you may have had the experience with fish, some fish seem to be very intelligent. Like they can notice a difference if you're carrying a Hawaiian sling, like a three prong, or like a deep water quadruple band. They know
how
like
to stay
how close,
just out of range.
And they also know if you're just carrying a camera, and they'll allow you to get closer if you're just carrying a camera. And there's something really beautiful about just like getting to that meditative state of trying to just shoot photos of fish, especially like very sensitive pelagic fish. And then also it's just so awesome to shoot photos of massive predators like whale sharks and bigger sharks and stuff like that.
Oh man, that's fascinating. So I want to talk a bit about Seatopia and it has evolved. So my understanding is that you first were not doing this company as just a direct-to-consumer box that people can get. You were working more specifically with chefs. Is that right? Why don't you just give me a little bit of just the evolution of what was the first iteration of this?
The first iteration was working with that farm in La Paz and realizing that our product was being commoditized and our customers didn't actually know if they're getting it from our farm or another farm. And thus there wasn't an incentive that was rewarding us for using an algae-based feed versus GMO corn and soy or fish oil, fish meal that may be contaminated with PCBs or whatever. So that huge risk was very directly mitigated by bringing a whole fresh fish direct to a restaurant. And because the farm was in Mexico, and because like most farms or farmers, selling through distributors made most sense, that's how the whole industry worked. And especially with fish, which are highly perishable, it makes sense just to work with professionals that have been doing this, right? But being this sort of I'll figure it out guy, I brought some whole fresh fish to a friend of mine that at the time was the produce buyer for the Jelena Restaurant Group here in Southern California, which is a renowned farm-to-table restaurant. And he was like, damn, this is amazing, and showed it to the chef. And Travis was like, wow, that's beautiful. Like, I want to learn more. And next thing you know, I started working with restaurants and chefs that previously had been using our product, but only sometimes, because they didn't actually know which product they were getting. They just would order from their distributor sushi grade yellowtail. And sometimes it would come from us. Sometimes it would come from a different farm. Sometimes it would just be like labeled as yellowtail from Mexico. Sometimes it would say aquaculture from Mexico, but there wasn't a detail to the level that you have familiarity to in, let's say, beef. So with beef, you ask for Diamond Mountain Ranch or White Oak Pastures, or there's specific farms and farming methods and specific species that you get and specific cuts that you get. And that wasn't happening through this commoditized distribution. So I started bringing whole fresh fish, and I ended up building a boutique direct import and distribution business, and then started working with a handful of other farms in Mexico, and then more and more farms from around the world, because we were now on the menu at some of the most prestigious Michelin star restaurants. The names of those farms was now on that menu, and we were bringing chefs to visit the farms, and that connection was authentic and it was legit. And it was like the type of relationship that any farm to table restaurant or human should have, knowing where their food comes from and being able to support the best farms and the best farming practices. And that's what I was doing before COVID.
Mm. For how many years?
That started in 2016.
Okay. What would you say to someone who says, I don't want farmed fish? That shit has a bunch of antibiotics in it. It's crowded. I want wild caught. Wild caught fish is the best, and I don't want to deal with this. And it's insane that a Michelin star restaurant would even serve farmed fish. What would you say to that person?
Okay, but
it's not weed, man.
One, it's not scalable or sustainable. So should a commercial business be putting more pressure on the wild stock? There's indisputable evidence that the gross catch from the wild plateaued. We are not finding more fish, and yet demand continues to grow. So should we continue to apply more pressure on wild stock and say, I only want wild caught, when there's not enough and overfishing is decimating our oceans? And that doesn't mean that all wild caught is bad. It just means that industrial scale fishing practices are not sustainable. So that said, we need aquaculture. We just need to do it well. So what farms are doing it well? Just like with beef and chicken, there are farms that produce commodity products for people who don't really care, and they just want cheap soy-fed, corn-fed chicken that, you know, they batter with, you know, batter and fry and whatever. But if you want the best quality, the best tasting, the most nutritious chicken and corn, or excuse me, chicken, corn, beef, whatever, you're going to get it from a farm that is feeding it the best ingredients in the most humane environment, getting the most nutritious diet. And those farms and those farming practices matter. And ordering from that specific farm is important. And it's exactly the same thing. There's literally no difference in aquaculture. You simply need to know the types of farms and the types of farming methods and be asking what's in the feed. Because the idea that all farms use antibiotics is just misinformation. Antibiotics are used when either the feed they're using is not nutritious and thus the fish are more prone to disease, and thus, you know, they're just trying to save money by giving them corn and soy that is causing inflammation in their gut, and thus they're more likely to have disease outbreaks, and so they give them preventative antibiotics. That is one model of farming, but it's not the only model of farming. There's a whole other model of farming, which Zootopia is focused on fostering, which is using the most nutritious feed that is actually beneficial to the animals, and pairing different species together in an environment, like a polyculture environment, integrated multi-trophic aquaculture. That model of farming actually can provide net positive quantifiable benefit to the environment, like increasing biodiversity, increasing oxygen levels, and removing carbon from the ocean, reversing ocean acidification, these types of farms should be celebrated, and we should be asking for these farms. And the reason why Michelin star restaurants use farmed products is because they've had these experiences, they are more educated on these topics, and they also want something that tastes good consistently and is always and is available. And that is the benefit of farming, is that if you control the feed and control the environment, you get a consistent output. Mm. And that is a beautiful thing when done right. That is the evolution of humankind, the transition from hunters to gatherers and farmers. That is what Jacques Cousteau said. We need to transition from hunters to farming the ocean. We also need to be thoughtful and nuanced to do it, not just in the model of industrial scale monoculture, but how do we replicate what we've learned about permaculture and do that in the ocean? And that is what we refer to in the industry as integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, where you pair, for example, a salmon farm with a shellfish farm and a kelp farm. And that's just at the that's kind of at the surface. And then underneath, you can have things like sea cucumbers, lobster, sea urchins, and the way that all these organisms work together symbiotically to take the poop from the salmon to feed the shellfish and to feed the kelp and to feed the sea cucumbers and to create a healthier environment and work symbiotically, where there's now more biodiversity in the environment, there's more oxygen in the environment, they're pulling the carbon out of the ocean. That model, that's also farming, but it is doing it in a net positive way. And those are the examples of aquaculture done right that should be celebrated. And that's what Seatopia is about. And so somebody who would say, I don't want to eat farm fish, I would say, well, maybe you just don't know enough about farming practices and the misinformation that was perpetuated or disseminated about early stage aquaculture. So aquaculture as an industry has only been around since the 60s and 70s were some of the first commercial farms for salmon, and the evolution, and it's come a long way, you know, right, from the first farms that they just ground up bait fish and then fed that to the salmon, and then whatever was in that bait fish was now magnified in those salmon. Things like mercury or PCBs that are unfortunately in the ocean and in those wild fish. And then sort of phase two, which was feeding them corn and soy, and phase three, kind of where we're at today, fish 3.0, fish meat is sort of optimizing the feed for the right ratio of omega-3s to omega-6s and the right ratios of protein. So utilizing microalgae-based oils and alternative proteins like mycelium and soldier fly larvae, these models of feeding fish clean inputs results in clean poop. And that nitrogen from a salmon that has fed a healthy diet, it is absolutely superfoods for organisms like those shellfish and the kelps and the sea urchins. The problem is when you're feeding them things that are not healthy for that environment, if you're feeding them antibiotics or you're feeding them corn and soy.
How does mercury end up in fish?
It's bioaccumulating in the fats and muscle tissues because we have, since the industrial age, been putting large quantities of mercury into the atmosphere that falls through coal fire plants mainly, and that falls down into the with rain and goes down rivers and ends up in the ocean, and zooplankton and phytoplankton are eating it. And then it goes up a trophic level into sardines and anchovies, and it goes up and magnifies into the mackerel, and then it goes up to the next level. So it concentrates and magnifies through a process of bioaccumulation, so that the larger the fish, the higher the levels of mercury. And you know, so if you're looking at bluefin tuna, for example, the levels are higher than the FDA recommends that women of childbearing age consume, or if you're pregnant or trying to conceive, you shouldn't be eating it. And if you look at like a killer whale, they're just absolutely toxic to the levels that we believe, there are scientific reports that propose that the entire species could collapse within 100 years.
And how do farmed fish avoid mercury? If this is air, if mercury is in the air or in the water systems, like how would you actually avoid that from a farming standpoint?
There's a few different ways you do it, and all has to do with the feed. Mm. So are the fish foraging and eating other sardines and anchovies, or are they being fed a controlled diet? And then what is in that controlled diet? So if the diet is just ground up sardines and anchovies, they're getting the same thing that the wild fish were getting. But if you then transition it to soy and corn, now they're not getting it. But even better, if you just go to the base trophic level of microalgae for the very important oils, the omega-3s that fish are famously healthy for, are not produced by fish. Omega-3s are produced by microalgae. And microalgae can be grown at an industrial scale and fed directly to the fish in these pellets. And that microalgae paired with other proteins like the mycelium proteins and the soldier fly larva are not contaminated with mercury that has bioaccumulated through the environment. Mm. So you go just to a different type of feed that doesn't have that in it. And unfortunately, our bait fish, our sardines, our anchovies have levels of mercury because they've been eating zooplankton and phytoplankton.
So you have, that was fantastic, by the way. Well done. Well done. You know your shit. You have evolved your business model now to be a direct-to-consumer subscription box, kind of like a butcher box of seafood. How many farms are you working with? You know, you're nice enough to bring me over a box of this frozen fish that's now in my freezer. And it was an assortment of, you know, some salmon to tuna. How many farms are you working with now to organize? Like, give me a little bit of the story from an operational standpoint, how you get this fish to people's doorstep that is sashimi grade. Like, so conceivably I could just thaw this fish and eat it raw.
Yeah. Well, to be clear, there's no tuna on our menu. there are people ranching tuna, and there are two farms I know of in the world that are farming tuna, raising them from eggs, getting them breed, but it is very difficult to do. Most people ranch them, so they just catch wild tuna and then fatten them up on sardines or whatever, and that is not something that I believe is scalable and should not be condoned as a industrial scale practice. That's fine if some people are going to do it, but to be really clear, is that a model of food production that should be scaled and be considered truly sustainable? That's not the Seatopia vision. So the fish that we work with are from the farms that we've identified as the best farms in the world. So we're working with farms in upstate New York that are producing steelhead trout and land-based recirculating aquaculture systems. We're working with, there's another one in also in New York State doing coho. There's farms in the open ocean, in the Faroe Islands, in Norway, in Baja, in Hawaii, in Chile, and so not just open ocean, but also land-based recirculating aquaculture systems, which are the best farms that have the most appropriate species with the best in-class diet that is being an example that we want to celebrate. So, we're working with about a dozen farms at the moment, and it continually evolves seasonally. It's different farms. Some farms are quite small and don't have year-round production. We're working with farms in New Zealand and farms here in the U.S. And it just depends on what is available that time of the year. But we've just said, like, it's not necessarily about, like, we're only going to work with local farms. We really just want to work with the best farms in the world that need their story told and that provide a product that we can stand behind, that we actually can test. So every farm that we work with has to have a third-party audited sustainability certifications from either BAP or ASC or something comparable, and that's kind of like our base level of filtration. And then we take the products and send them to a laboratory, actually a couple different laboratories now that we're working with, that can quantify things like heavy metal levels to the parts per billion. And we've internally created our own sort of standard, and we won't sell anything that has more than 0.1 parts per million of mercury. And that makes it safe for even pregnant. My wife, while she was pregnant, ate sushi grade seafood almost daily in her third trimester, because that was the only protein that she felt that she could digest. So, you know, the bioavailable proteins and omega-3s of a sushi grade piece of fish, you can't get that from, you know, most places because concerns of either mercury or parasites. But because of the feed and the freezing process, we know that this is clean, we know that it's safe, and we have that with every product. Every product is tested for toxins and frozen via this flash frozen process, which is a very unique methodology for freezing fish as quickly as possible and bringing that temperature down so that you have as little ice crystals in there as possible. And then it's held at those temperatures. We don't have fluctuations in temperature. It literally gets frozen to these super sub, like negative 20, 30 degrees. And then our freezers keep it there, and it's delivered to your door with dry ice. So there's a focus on preserving the texture and the quality of that fish that you can't get through traditional supply chains that are, you know, the temperature's fluctuating, they put it out on the fish counter, you don't actually know when it was frozen or defrosted or how many times it was frozen or defrosted. They're not necessarily using the like blast freezers, nitrogen freezers when they're freezing it to begin with, so you're not getting the same sort of textural experience.
One idea that we've been circling around during this conversation is one of scale and how wild caught can't really support the scale of human consumption, the scale at which we are depleting the oceans, and with the farms that have the worst practices, they tend to, if I'm not mistaken, have some of the largest scale.
Yes.
Because they want to make as much money as possible. So you have, let's say things start going very well for Seatopia, and 5 years from now you have 100x'd, 1,000x'd your business because people want this product. How are you going to be able to maintain those sustainability standards as this business scales?
It's a diversification of what people are eating and what farms are producing. So right now, farms that are large-scale monocultures don't introduce complexity, as it's referred to, which is, you know, integrated multi-trophic aquaculture. Oh my gosh, I have to have multiple different species. You're talking about not just, you know, a mooring system for a product, you know, a that is on the surface, but now we have mid-level water column, and we have different species on the seafloor, and like managing that complexity is impossible for a farm that is selling commodity products. Unless each farm is being celebrated or each species is valued appropriately, it doesn't really scale. So what we are doing is educating people to be better buyers in a way. So in the same way that people buying beef 10 years ago, 20 years ago, they just wanted USDA Prime. The only way that regenerative beef and grass-fed beef has evolved is by people specifically asking for different farming practices. Nobody knew what free-range, grass-fed, pasture-raised meant 20 years ago, you know, or at least not people in cities that were buying regular USDA Prime.
So are you rotating the menus that people can get at Seatopia depending on time of year?
We're not artificially rotating it, but some of these farms are quite small and what they can harvest is limited. And what we're really doing is we're trying to introduce new species and try and get people to try something different. Like everybody wants tuna and shrimp, and that's fine. We offer those. We don't offer tuna, but we do offer shrimp and we offer salmon, but we offer multiple species of salmon. Like there's lots of species in the salmonoid family, and we don't just eat coho salmon. We can't just all eat coho salmon. It is amazing, but we also should be eating steelhead trout and rainbow trout, and beyond trout, we should be eating other species of whitefish, and we should be eating other parts of the fish. We should be eating the fish livers. We should be looking at incorporating sea cucumbers, and we have to place more value on kelp and different types of algae as food sources, not just as supplements or commoditized oil, but how do we really place value on center of the plate, bringing something like kelp to the center of the plate? That's what we're still trying to figure out how to do, because if these farms only place value on the muscle fillet loin of a salmon, then that's all they're going to produce. But if people, consumers, place value on all of the organisms in that ecosystem, it helps these farms justify those investments and make this a more scalable thing, paired with other things like policy, government policy, that's really helpful. But I think the consumer needs to become more educated.
It is strange that fish are the last wild animals that we eat at scale. And if you look at the incentives in place, when you think about, even good people who just work in the fishing industry, their incentives are to make more money. And it's, humans are just incentive-based animals. I think that we need to, as we think about solutions, look at our own frailties as a species and create the correct incentives, both on the consumer level, but also from a legislation standpoint. I do think that legislation and laws are really just incentives put in place for humans, right? Like, you don't drive drunk because the incentive to not do it is high enough because you don't want to lose your license and, blow $10,000.
Yeah. And even still, when that was put in place, people freaked out. Like, don't tell me what to do, But, if you look at history, so many species collapsed and industries collapsed, whether you're looking at the cod fishery or you name it. We did not and do not as a species have the ability to control those impulses. It seems that the desire to make money, especially when you have entrenched industries, entire communities that have invested livelihoods into these operations, into it's their culture, and it's also in our DNA. It is part of our history, having a connection to the ocean. We came from the ocean. We are drawn towards it in such a deep and profound romantic way that we want to celebrate wild caught fish. We want to have our fish and our sustenance come from it. It's just so embedded in who we are. But we have to change that relationship, because there's so many examples of towns, communities that were dependent on one species of fishing, and they thought they were managing the maximum sustainable yield, and they simply were not, because there are these other factors that snowball. But
are there any examples that you can think of?
I mean, the cod fishery is an example.
What happened? I don't know that story.
It was at one time the one of the largest fisheries on the eastern seaboard, and the entire industry, the entire population collapsed, and the entire fishing fleet had to basically be repurposed. And for years, the entire communities were distraught, and you see that happen time and time again with different fisheries and in different communities. And one of the reasons why I was doing aquaculture in Mexico is that Mexico is more advanced in aquaculture today because they were also more advanced in depleting their oceans and allowing industrial scale practices to overfish. And what happened is you had entire communities now that were once relatively self-sufficient and producing and even exporting fish, all of a sudden out of work, out of money, and dependent on government subsidies. So the government invested more heavily in re-educating, retooling, and accelerating aquaculture in Mexico. And that is something that will be happening more in the United States as communities are out of work.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I have always found, I don't know a ton about fisheries throughout Mexico, but I have always noticed there seems to be a literacy among the Mexican people around fishing and just and utilizing these practices in more sustainable ways. We're talking about in Northern Baja, like you can drive down through Ensenada and you see fish farms off the coast, which is it does take sometimes, you know, breaking your arm to start wearing wrist guards, so to speak, right?
Yeah. And not all those farms in Mexico are farms that we support. I've been to all of those farms. I've swam in those pens with those tuna off the coast of Salsipuedes and off of Punta Banda. And it's an amazing experience to be amongst thousands of massive mussels, but it is not something that we sell, and but it is more effective than those communities just catching all of the fish and having no more industry, right? So the Mexican government has been more proactive in supporting aquaculture, and NOAA in the U.S., the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, has been very pro aquaculture, and there are proposals to expand offshore aquaculture in Southern California in the offshore. And there's a number of sites that they've identified that are appropriate for offshore aquaculture, and it's really going to be a matter of what policies will be implemented that hopefully will be in line with good stewardship of the ocean. Because if I had my way, and I've had conversations with these people, and it's the Seatopia vision is a policy that requires integrated multi-trophic aquaculture. If you're going to put a species like, let's just say, steelhead trout or white sea bass in an offshore aquaculture site, there is a quantifiable amount of effluent that's going to come off of that site. So at their best, the feed conversion ratio, there's still going to be like 20% of whatever feed goes in there is going to come out as poop. Well, that nutrient can be absorbed. You can quantify how much nutrients are going to go in the water, and you can require that the permits also have a required amount of remediation in the form of shellfish and kelp around it, and other sort of organisms on the benthic environment on the seafloor. And if you have that built into the permitting processes, you can quantifiably create a net positive impact on that environment that would attract more species to that environment, that would create more spawning ground. You know, you have the ability to grow kelp offshore. The reason why we don't have expanded offshore kelp is because it's a nutrient lacking environment. Offshore, there's not enough nutrients to support kelp beyond the fact that they don't have a holdfast, but there's just not enough nutrients. Whereas you introduce something like steelhead or white sea bass, and you're feeding them and they're pooping, that nutrient all of a sudden
it has the fertilizer.
It has the fertilizer it needs, and the shellfish and the kelp then become a whole ecosystem for a number of other species that want to come in there and create and appreciate and use that habitat. Mm. And while the shellfish are creating those shells, they're pulling the carbon. That calcification process is pulling carbon out of the ocean, which is super important right now with ocean acidification, with the ocean absorbing all the excess carbon that's now in the atmosphere.
What do you feel like you don't do well as a business? Well, like if you were to, I think that, you know, you're doing a lot right, obviously, with sustainable practices. Like if you were to really try and poke holes in what you're doing or areas where you see where you have a lot of improvement to do and a ways to go, this could be sustainability. It could be communication with your customers. It could be, you know, just where do you feel like you're like, fuck, this is, we're getting a 3 out of 10 right here.
When we first launched Seatopia, we were zero plastic. Mm. And it was such an awesome thing to do. No styrofoam, no plastics. Already all of our carbon footprint is offset, and we plant kelp with every single order. So on a one-for-one basis, every time you place an order, there's a kelp tree being planted specifically for you. And that is not kelp to be harvested. That's just kelp for reforestation of natural habitat and reprotected areas. That said, when we launched, we were working with, we still work with this company called Grounded Packaging that produces these bio-based plastics for our IQF products. So like shrimp and scallops that don't need to be vacuum sealed. And that plastic, it was, is 100% recyclable. They also had a, have a 100% compostable plastic that we were using that did not, that we are not currently using, and we're looking for another supplier. In the interim, it kills me that we're using regular plastic. It is still recyclable plastic, but that is a thing that needs to be improved. And there are people that we're talking to that are doing R&D on, but like to be truly sustainable, we have to get away from the use of plastics throughout the entire supply chain. Mm. When I started Seatopia, it was like, no styrofoam, no plastic. We're going to do this right. And we lost so much product, unfortunately. Yeah. Like
plastic's a great fucking way to, it's a great product. Yeah. But, you know, it's got its downsides.
Compostable. But, yeah. Like they still have it. It just doesn't work for our specific case because when we ship it in close proximity to dry ice, it would lose its seal and it would start to decompose. Yeah. But it was an awesome plastic. It was literally like compostable in your home compost at home. And also, it didn't need an oxygen environment. So it could also compost in the ocean if it got into.
That's fascinating.
So, but
always room to improve. But dude, you really know your stuff. This was such an impressive.
More species. we got to figure out how to get more people eating kelp and eating sea cucumbers and eating shellfish and all those other cool species that people aren't currently appreciating. Nice. I'm not sure what the solution is there, but we're working on it.
Let's keep the education coming. This was so much fun, man. I learned a lot during this podcast. You know your stuff, and it's just an exciting project that you're working on, and was happy to dive in a little bit deeper with you, both into your story as well as the business.
My pleasure.
Where can people reach out to you and get in touch?
Seatopia.fish is our URL.
Nice.
.fish. Seatopia.fish. At Seatopia on the gram. Yeah, and that's about it. Yeah, I think I'm on LinkedIn and
all the rest.
Yeah.
James, this was so much fun, man. Thank you again for stopping by.
Much love.
See ya.
Aloha.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.